You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 5th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer, public historian Elizabeth Catt, author of Pure America, Eugenics and the Making of Modern Virginia. Also on the program today, federal judge says former Attorney General Bill Barr lied about his role in obstructing the Trump investigation. White House looks for 70% of U.S. adults to be vaccinated in the next 8 weeks by July 4th. Meanwhile, India sets new COVID records for infections. And Pfizer, congratulations, is set to generate $26 billion in 2021. Rudy Giuliani, meanwhile, reportedly mad that Trump and allies won't help with his legal bills or even pay him for his work in the past. Bibi Netanyahu fails to form a coalition government. Study shows that Biden capital gains tax would hit only the fewest and richest of Americans. The Donald Trump Facebook ban has been upheld by Facebook's review board. So Trump launches a blog instead. Lastly, Montana ends extra unemployment benefits because of a supposed shortage of workers, which should read a shortage of workers willing to work for less than a living wage. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma Vigeland is here. Hello, Emma. How are you?
I'm okay.
I tried to mix it up a little bit and I could.
I got what?
Oh, you got your sneeze in just before the show started.
I snuck the sneeze in right as you were reading some of those headlines. So perfect timing.
Well done. Very well done.
Yeah. Who knows if there's actually snot dripping down my face right now? We'll see.
There is not. Okay. But if there is, everyone's going to know.
So they
go,
enjoy,
stop the sneeze. Yeah. Stop the sneeze,
stop
as it
the
were.
Snot, right.
Allergy season, ladies and gentlemen. That's all part of what we got going on here.
Yeah,
today.
It's kind of a year long thing for me, the sneezing.
Year long.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't really know. I'm not gonna deal with it. Just gonna live with
it. I'm sure it'll go away eventually.
Right.
Over time.
Yeah.
In the end, it always does. All right, well, let's get right into this. I found this pretty amusing. Over at Fox and Friends, they attempted to have some children on. Remember, they're trying to leverage the, what we've seen from the Republicans at this point, which is not to say that they're not going to do quite well in the midterms, but the thing that they seem to be running on is a crisis at the border, which certainly is not the crisis that they contend it is. And Joe Biden, I think, in the White House, at the very least, are no longer quite as defensive as they were a month or two ago, as evidenced by their responding to the pressure from the broader left to, at the very least, maintain their 62,500 refugee cap, which they now claim that they will not be able to hit in terms of numbers, sheer numbers, just because I think it was so slow for this fiscal year. raised to double that for the next fiscal year. But it is for on the Republican docket, there is the immigration crisis. And then it's just a matter of mask mandates and getting kids back to school. And of course, we're a year and a half out from the election. Those two things, I imagine, are going to be a much different place. But they really, really want to maintain this dynamic. And so Fox and Friends invites a bunch of three elementary school kids, middle school kids on to try and further this theme that somehow Joe Biden is being irresponsible in, I guess, not demanding that all children go back to school. The segment is called Failing Our Children.
Yeah, and the F is like a big F you get on a test.
There you go.
See a big red F in a circle. Pick up on that, guys, when you
Yes,
you
we're failing
this.
Our children. And
there we go.
Well, out of the mouths of babes, although this kid is actually, I think, probably in his early teens, sixth grader. So
he's like swagged out with those AirPods.
Yep. There and here is Brian Kilmeade, who looks like he wants to get into a fight with this kid after he doesn't get the response he wants for the failing our children segment.
How close are you to getting back in the room? What do you miss most about not being in school?
I miss most, obviously, seeing my friends and all the after-school activities that I've done. And I think that we're very, very close getting back to school. And I think that the way that our new president is handling things is a very good way. And we would have not have gone to this if it were still the last president.
Really? That's hard to believe because the last president was saying, I want every kid back in school. So, Lily, for you, what is your hope knowing the numbers are going down and the governor might be opening up?
Really?
Yeah, really.
Really, Bobby?
Yeah.
Really? You're going to unman me like this on my own show? He became Trump there a little bit. But
the girl in the quadrant below Kilmeade is nodding during those specific comments.
Right.
And look, this is just there's two ways for the children to go back to school. And one is that we just decide randomly based upon nothing that the kids are going back to school. And that is if the Trump administration had the ability to do that, that's what they would have done. The Biden administration, I certainly didn't hear anybody 4 months ago say, and there's a lot to be critical of the Biden administration, and I suspect there's going to be more on other topics soon. But in terms of returning to some semblance of normalcy, there is no bigger The only way to get there was to vaccinate as many people as possible, as soon as possible. And certainly no one, when Joe Biden was pledging 100 million vaccines shots in 100 days, nobody was saying, he's undershooting. He's purposely setting expectations low. No, everyone thought, like, don't know if he could hit it.
Right.
And he surpassed it.
In half the time, essentially.
And so there is no doubt that's the only other way that you get the kids back into school is to protect their parents.
And the teachers.
And the teachers. And the people who are working in the schools. And the bottom line is that's the story with my own kids. My elementary school kid is back in school now. In New York City, it is now 5 days a week, really, basically starting next week. They're back this week. And it's because everyone around him who is an adult, including the teachers, the staff at the school, including his parents and a babysitter, they are vaccinated. And so the danger is not completely mitigated. There are other people out there who can't get vaccinations and who haven't yet. But it is significantly diminished.
And, you know, good on you for bringing it back to policy, but I'm going to bring it back to kill me for a second.
Sure.
Because we have to, right? It just occurred to me. I think this is a roundabout way to go after teachers' unions as well. I know they've done it more explicitly, but this is, even though it has no long-term strategy, because this kids are going to be back to school, I think, full-time in a regular capacity, I'd imagine, in the fall, barring some unforeseen, you know, calamity here. But how small does Brian Kilmeade have to be to basically correct this child on air? This kid's on national TV, and he couldn't help himself. I mean, he handled it incredibly well, that young boy. I mean, he was really poised. But how insecure and insignificant do you have to be to actually just, you know, put him down in that way?
I get the sense that Kilmeade has a little bit of an anger issue that you always see bubble up a little bit. He was mad. He was not just mad at the kid.
It's very 1950s repressed, like the kid is speaking out and, you know, that kid should be seen, not heard, essentially. He should be yes-anding me. He should be agreeing with me.
I think Kilmeade is mad at his producer, too. Like, who didn't properly vet this kid?
Yeah. I mean, shocker. Shocker. Young people, I know this is going to be news to Kilmeade, aren't Republicans traditionally, unless their parents tell them to be.
Look, the bottom line is that when you are in sixth grade, and I would say even younger, in this context, for the past year, you have been acutely aware of how COVID is being handled in a way that I think is far more advanced and sophisticated than kids generally have an awareness of any type of public policy. Because every day your life is defined by this. You're seeing the anxiety from your parents. You're aware that you're not going to school. You're aware that your teachers, you're not seeing your friends. All of this is tied up. And so the level of sophistication, I think, of a lot of these kids relative to the what is going on with COVID is exceptionally high. And literally only maybe a 4-year-old wouldn't know that Donald Trump actively prevented this country from getting past COVID, or a hack on Fox News who's paid to do that. Those are the two cohorts. And so that's that. All right. We got to take a quick break. And when we do, we will be back with Elizabeth Catt, author of Pure America, Eugenics and the Making of Modern Virginia. Hey, folks, have you ever attempted, do you go into, well, maybe you don't want to tell me this. Do you browse in incognito mode? Do you go to sites you don't?
No, not really.
I sometimes do. I will concede. Nothing too exciting. It's just there are times where I'm like, you know what? I don't want this site to record my stuff.
I should probably do that when I'm like looking up right wing clips, right? So it doesn't get into my algorithm. I just never think to do it. Yeah.
The problem is it's probably not as incognito as you think, because incognito mode, like Chrome itself, is a Google product. Google has even stated that incognito does not mean invisible. So how do you actually make yourself as invisible as possible online? Well, ExpressVPN. Even in an incognito mode, your online activity still gets tracked. Data brokers still buy and sell your data. One of these data points is your IP address. Well, with ExpressVPN, your connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server, and your IP address, it's masked. Every time you connect to ExpressVPN, you get a random IP address shared by many other ExpressVPN customers, making it harder for third parties to identify you. This is why sometimes people use this for stuff like Netflix and this and that. You want to choose a different region in which you're watching. Mm-hmm. But it also provides security for your connection and also your identity. ExpressVPN, super easy to use no matter what device you're on. You can use it on your phone. You can use it on your laptop. You can use it on your tablet or even your smart TV. You one tap of one button and you get instant protection. So if you really want to go incognito and protect your privacy, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN. Visit expressvpn.com/majority and get 3 extra months for free. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/majority. ExpressVPN.com/majority. Also, in the past, I've talked about this. I went through a period in my life where, I mean, a long extended period, actually, where I did not wear any deodorant because I did not want any of the junk in it to get into my system. I'm not a biologist or a chemist. I don't know. I haven't spent a lot of time with the data, to be honest with you, on this. But my feeling was, like, I just don't want it in my system. And then after a while, I realized, like, but yeah, but I also don't want to stink. So if you're like me, here's the good news. You don't have to stink anymore. Native. It has your back. Native cares about products you put in your body, on your body, rather, and they stop the stink, but they do it in the right way. You already know about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant. They also have body wash. They also have toothpaste. And they have a brand new mineral-based sunscreen. And not only do they have the sort of rub-on kind, also the spray kind. And not oily.
Yes, and so, that's ideal for lazy me who also needs sunscreen in the summer.
I'll tell you what it's ideal for, is your kids. Because rubbing stuff onto my 8-year-old's face is probably one of the hardest things in the world to do. So the spray is awesome. It is spray with the zinc lotion, but it's not greasy. I get it on there easy. He doesn't complain about it afterwards. It's lightweight. It absorbs quickly. You can choose between, of course, my favorite, the unscented, or the coconut and pineapple, which is actually my kids like.
Oh, yep. I like that.
And you can get their deodorant and body wash in amazing scents like coconut and vanilla, citrus and herbal musk, lavender and rose, and my favorite, unscented. You can even build your own personalized product bundles. You mix and match three of your favorite scents. You keep them on rotation, so you got something for every occasion. You know, for me, it's just like I don't want to put junk on my body, and I don't like scents, and so Native works for me perfectly. Like I say, they do have other scents. The mint, I enjoy, and coconut stuff in generally, but you know, anything herbal and musk, not for me. But for other people, look, everybody's body reacts differently, so I can only tell you what I like. So, and I think, Emma, you know, like if there's any smell in here that's even slightly foreign, I start to lose my mind.
Yep.
And sometimes I have a some type of like reaction. Bottom line, stay fresh, stay clean with Native by going to nativedeo.com/majority report. Or once you get there, use the promo code Majority Report at checkout and you get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/majority report, or use the promo code Majority Report at checkout for 20% off your first order. As always, we'll put these links in the show description and the YouTube description. You can check it out there. Now I want to welcome to the program Elizabeth Catt. She's a writer, public historian, author of Pure America, Eugenics, and the Making of Modern Virginia. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me.
And I'm here with Emma Vigeland. And this is a really fascinating look at history, but also the way that we in this country suppress history and the way that history is connected to modern to today. I mean, it's impressive and all that. So congratulations. Let's just start with you set the temporal context for this. This is coming out of Reconstruction, the Reconstruction era, which, you know, anybody who listens to the show knows that I'm sort of obsessed with. But I am increasingly, too. It's amazing how much of a black memory hole that era is whether it deals with, I've interviewed people about racism against Chinese people, the dispossession of Native Americans during this time, which has, which I want to get to when we start talking about the Shenandoah Park. But set the context for us temporally in that era, and then we can talk more about why we seem to forget these things.
So the context is the early 20th century, talking about a moment when ideas about eugenics, which is the science of engineering human reproduction for the betterment of society, when they move from the realms of books and laboratories into public life in a really profound way, taking on the context of almost a social movement. And what really facilitates that is this belief that eugenics can make a lot of solutions to social problems that sort of elite white people favored at the time. So suppression of Black people, keeping women in a subordinate position, thinking about ways to continue exploiting the poor, restricting the types of people that could come to America. It made those solutions more palatable by presenting the people that they were trying to target as their beliefs as scientifically valid instead of based on prejudice. And so the context that we're looking at is how the United States, and in particular Virginia, which is what I write about, makes that leap from kind of keeping these ideas within the realm of science to translating them into a social movement and seeing them as a universal application for solving social problems, but also keeping their social hierarchy intact.
And there's also there's multiple economic motives too here, right? In terms of both what these folks represent in terms of labor, what they represent as in terms of potential cost to society. And we should also say this is around the time where we're talking about, you know, the innovation of the income tax and, you know, the needing of funds for World War One. So there's this desire to sort of like cut expenses on some level. I mean, there's an austerity story to this, too.
Yeah, 100%. Eugenics organizations would circulate, you know, postcards and flyers, sending them to the, you know, mailboxes of Americans that would say things like, you know, every 15 minutes, 100 of your dollars, meaning tax dollars, goes to the care of persons with hereditary degeneracy and things like that. So it's a story about taking sort of a range of people who are already problematic to this elite white society. So people who are disfavored because of their race, people who are disfavored because of their gender, their disability, their economic status, and sort of reinventing them as a group that was destined to perpetually drain society of its resources unfairly. And so the idea, which is wildly popular, even physicians would sort of enumerate the social debts of the people that they were, you know, quote unquote, trying to treat, but that they were creating a societal debt that could never be paid and would be unfairly borne by successive generations of well-to-do white Americans.
How does this go from, I guess, the justification used during slavery that slave owners were benevolent by bringing African people over and enslaving them and engaging in the slave trade? I mean, that was some of the ways that white people justified their racist thinking, right? Like, how does that evolve to this scientific racism and eugenics that, I guess, was so dominant at the start of the 20th century?
Right. So I can give you the best example from Virginia is a man who worked for the University of Virginia named Paul Brandon Barringer, who was one of the early leaders of its medical program. And he took what he would call the Negro problem into his expertise and sort of imprinted it with eugenic thought. So it's a really interesting way to see the transition of those ideas from these kind of older hysterical conspiracy theory, you know, sounding beliefs into something that sounded really fresh and modern and scientific to their ears. And so his idea was that, you know, there was just natural barbarism among Black people, and that without the sort of mitigating, supporting, sort of tamping down, you know, influence of slave owners, that they were the people who had kept all that in check. And now that America was post-slavery, that there was a real fear that those impulses and urges and violence and sort of societal disorder that would return. And so, Behringer talked about restricting reproduction as one way to kind of solve that problem. And there's one side of this that is very much focused on sort of controlling the lives of Black people. And then there's the other side that sort of takes those ideas and that impulse and that desire for control and sort of diffuses it, makes it much more malleable and applies it to sort of a wider dragnet of individuals.
You know, I apologize. I probably should have started off this way, but will you just define for people what eugenics is? I don't want to assume that everybody has a full grasp on that.
Sure. Eugenics is the science of engineering sort of human reproduction for the betterment of society. It has active side. It has positive sides and negative sides. Those are not really moral descriptors. We just mean that sometimes eugenicists are concerned with adding people to the population, and sometimes eugenicists are concerned with subtracting people from the population. So adding people to the population, positive eugenics might be creating incentives or encouragement for well-born people to sort of get together and reproduce, similar to how, you know, the English aristocracy managed itself. Negative eugenics is trying to subtract people from the population. And largely in America, what that looks like is enacting things like forced sterilization laws that sort of gave the state liberty to control the reproduction of people. But negative eugenics can also look like things like immigration quotas, which restrict immigration from certain countries.
All right. Well, tell us the story of Carrie Buck, because this will give sort of some grounding for folks to understand sort of the dynamic taking place here.
So Carrie Buck was the first person legally sterilized in the state of Virginia. Virginia passes a eugenics law in 1924. It takes a while for that law to be tested by the higher courts, which is what the architects of that law want to happen. Carrie Buck is selected as the first test case. And the reason that she's attractive to the people in power is because she's a young white woman. She's about 17 or 18 years old. She's been in the foster care system, or what they called, you know, what passed for the foster care system at that time, since she was a toddler. She's been living with a family for a decade, working primarily as their housekeeper, as sort of like a domestic mother's helper. And sort of during her teenage years, she's assaulted and raped by the nephew of her foster mother, and she becomes pregnant. This is going to be a big scandal for the foster family, because even if they can blame Carrie, sort of like present her as a woman out of control, their job is to create kind of a benevolent influence on her as foster parents, and they failed at that. So what they do instead is sort of orchestrate for Carrie a fictitious history of mental problems, outbursts, tantrums, even epilepsy, to get her committed to an institution called the Lynchburg Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, which was sort of a catch-all institution for people who were thought to be hereditarily deficient in mental capacity. And so Carrie enters that institution after she has her daughter, Vivian. And there she's selected as a test case, and her, she's encouraged to, with legal advocates, go through the appeals process. The case ends up in the Supreme Court in 1927, which sides with the state of Virginia. The famous, you know, quote, three generations of imbeciles are enough from Oliver Wendell Holmes comes from that case. And Carrie is sterilized that fall.
This is Buck v. Bell.
And, Buck v. Bell.
Mm-hmm. And this... people should understand that this, in this case, that was 1927. This ruling in Buck v. Bell, maybe you can tell everybody, stays in, is the law of the land until 19. Do you want to finish? Because I think it's shocking to people.
Buck v. Bell is the law of the land everywhere. What happens, though, is that some states, like Virginia, start removing the eugenics laws that had been sort of legally sanctioned by Buck v. Bell voluntarily in the 1970s. So when I talk about Virginia, I usually use the dates 1924 to 1979, because that's when the last explicit eugenics law is taken off the books. But the legal precedent of Buck v. Bell has never been overturned. There's been momentum to try to overturn it. The ACLU has been very interested in Buck v. Bell and moments from its past, but no one has ever been successful at getting this law and the precedent it set overturned.
And we'll swing back around to the fact that it happened, at least to, it made the national press in the past, I don't know, what was it, 18 months ago, 12 months ago, when it came to immigrant women in this country.
Sure.
We will get there. Let's tell us about Joseph DeJarnett.
So Joseph DeJarnett was the superintendent of the hospital that is in my backyard. It's a hospital called Western State Hospital, one of five state hospitals in the Virginia system. And from about 1905 to 1943, Joseph DeJarnett was its superintendent. And he was one of the most vocal leaders of Virginia's eugenics movement. He was, for example, a expert witness in Buck v. Bell. He was the person sort of leading a charge to petition state senators, for example, to create momentum to pass these eugenic laws. He was one of the first people to call in the state of Virginia to call for what he would call the sterilization of all, quote, weaklings. He was almost obsessive with the idea of sterilization. His nickname was Joseph Sterilization DeJarnett, and he approved of it. And so he is a very significant figure in the history of Virginia eugenics, practiced at the hospital, which is located right down the road from me, and is, you know, the primary reason why I became interested in the subject of eugenics, just that kind of like spatial connection to that history. Under DeJarnett, about 1,200 people at Western State were sterilized, and then a couple hundred after his tenure. So all total, we're talking about 7,000, 8,000 people in Virginia, and then 1,700 at the institution that is close to me.
And we should say that was, I mean, he represented the sort of this turn towards eugenics, at least in the context of, he was the one to start to execute this at Western State facility, right? I mean, there was, what was the backdrop of sort of just like, I guess, medicine here? I mean, I watched The Nick a long time ago, and the eugenics came up as a theme in that, and it seemed to be part of an outgrowth of progress in the context of medicine, that this was an application. Talk about that, but also talk about it in the context of your assessment that these men in particular, and the ones who were involved in this, weren't just of their time. That you can make a value judgment on them that was not intrinsic to that era.
So the context of people like Joseph DeJarnett sort of coming into power in the 1920s is there's a lot of social problems that seem unsolvable. There's things like mental illness, disability, crime. Our life the life expectancy shoots up a little bit in this century. People are living longer lives. There's more immigrants, more people equals more disease. And so there's a genuine uptick in sort of like the concerns that populate their world. At the same time, they're coming off of, you know, previous generations who had quite different philosophies of patient care. They tried to reinvent things like psychiatric medicine as something that centered humane treatment of people with mental illness, believing that it might be possible for people who were institutionalized to be cured or healed, to return to society in some capacity. In DeJarnett's era, that kind of emphasis on cure turns into an emphasis on control. And containment, more and more people start passing the cost of sort of taking care of people who are disabled or mentally ill locally onto state hospitals. So that allows them, again, we're talking about, you know, the connection to austerity. That's a big one where, quote unquote, problem people get sent away to large state institutions where they can be more efficiently managed. And all of this lands on the shoulders of people like Joseph DeJarnett. It becomes his job to be less of a physician and more of a human accountant, where he's sort of perpetually calibrating sort of numbers of people who are ill, the future drain on society, the future cost of letting these people stay alive. And he is just advising the state and pressuring the state more and more to kind of move in this direction of sterilizing even more and more people. He once smarted, for example, that the Germans were beating us, meaning Americans, at our own game. And so that's the context. I personally, as you alluded to, kind of make a value judgment about people like DeJarnett. He was, I think he was a narcissist, a megalomaniac, sorry to use sort of the descriptions from the realm of psychiatry too, but he was somebody who was very invested in his own image. He wrote kind of very disturbing poetry about his patients. He seemed to very much enjoy the control that he had over their lives. So it wasn't just a man who is sort of put into this position of charting very choppy waters of social change in this moment and sort of the undeniable pressures of running a state institution in a time of austerity, but someone who considered himself as a riser to the occasion and wanted to be even more sort of known and attached to this cause.
Can you talk about, I guess, how in this time, as you mentioned, there's this rise in disease and uncertainty, and it seems like there is obviously some scientific growth and people trying to provide scientific explanations for a lot of the changes in their lives. I mean, scientific racism still exists today, but it almost seems like this time period was ripe for racist outcomes under the guise of factual scientific exploration, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, what eugenics did was allow an acknowledgement of a dire social situation. So the idea that there was the belief that these were pressing social problems, almost unsolvable, about to take American society completely off track and move it backwards into almost a state of de-evolution. But what they wrestled from that and why eugenics was particularly powerful for building this bridge is that, this was scientific progress. This was not something of the last century. It was not something that, in Virginia, I might say the Old South, for example, that the Old South would have done. It's kind of a very fresh take on something. And of course, the beauty of eugenics is that it was very malleable. Paul Lombardo, who is an expert on American eugenics, once called it a bottom feeder, takes whatever it needs to sustain itself. And I think that's a great way of looking at eugenics, to how it could be something that could sustain and invent scientific racism, but at the same time be something that could be used to create an incredibly large dragnet for poor white people as well.
Yeah, let's talk because this era is also, you tie it into this is and sort of brings us almost full circle to the future, I guess, or to the recent just the very recent past. This is also the same time that they are putting up a statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, and there is this sense of. And when you talk about control, there is this sense of like we in this instance being the wealthy white folks need to reassert ourselves during this period. This is a big growth for the KKK. I mean, put all that into context. Like, how do these things relate to each other?
So this is a time when Virginia is really focused on its self-image was one layer. So it really is concerned with charting a course that's different from the older version of itself, and also the wider South that has this kind of lingering reputation for being a backwards place. And so Virginians embrace eugenics as sort of a band-aid to kind of cosmetically recuperate the old South into the new. And the reason that Confederate, statues and monuments become so, the fascinating thing about them is they're animated by the same desire for to control race mixing. And so plopping down a statue at the boundary between a white neighborhood and a black neighborhood, as they did in Charlottesville with the Lee statue, is a strong message that say, this is our boundary. We're not going to tolerate transmission between these portals, between these worlds. And so that sounds very familiar to somebody who knows something about the Old South, but it would have also sounded very modern to people hearing it in 1924 Virginia, because they would have, been saying things like, and this is a quote, that one drop of blood makes the Negro is no longer a belief induced by race prejudice, but a scientific fact. And so imprinting those kind of modern spins on their older beliefs was incredibly valuable to maintain this kind of social order in the South, where they wanted to be cosmetically different, but not really destabilize their social hierarchy. And so the language that they use is eerily similar, but would have sounded, but would have been a type of code that they, a new kind of code that they were talking in.
And we should say it was that same year that the Racial Integrity Act, which decided, and the Sterilization Act were passed.
Yes. Bad year for Virginia.
Yeah, I guess so. And I want to circle back and just, you know, sort of flag like the idea that, and I think Emma was expressing this a little bit too, the idea that you can achieve the same ends, but do so in a different language.
Under the guise of scientific exploration, which sounds, you know, like a good thing.
Right. Is a neat trick, I guess. And we see that played over and mentioned that and we will get there. But I want to talk about the hotel, the Blackburn Inn, which you can see it is a really nice hotel.
Yes.
All right. Why is the Villages at Stoughton, and if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in the Blackburn Inn, why is that important to the story? Obviously, it's the same location as like the actual physical place in Webster State. But how does that history carry through into that place?
So, right, the hotel and this luxury housing development are sort of these two new enterprises that have been built from the bones of a former state psychiatric hospital, Western State, that we were talking about earlier. So in the place of this hospital now is quite nice accommodation for tourists and for sort of second home and vacation home buyers. I tend to think that eugenics in America is something that is really well researched, but not particularly well remembered. And we're talking about things like memory black holes in this conversation, and that's sort of exactly it. And I used to, you know, be able to see this hotel from in the development site from the window of my apartment in my neighborhood. I encountered it every day as it was kind of transforming into this new version of itself. And I was asking myself a lot of the questions that we've kind of danced around today is why is the memory attached to the American eugenics movement so uneven? What would it take to get communities talking about these difficult and you know, can be uncomfortable topics, but necessary topics? How does that history kind of live alongside something like a luxury development that sort of, you know, aligns that history quite strongly? And so as somebody who does history and sort of is really interested in the way people remember or don't remember things, this was a fascinating case study for me to see happen in real time. And the short version is the site itself claims a really narrow portion of its past that, you know, is a little bit more optimistic than the later DeJarnett era and what came after. And so I just am somebody who was perpetually wondering, well, where does that history go now that we can't really associate it with this site in which it lived? And those are the questions that sort of travel through Pure America, but also, you know, answering them in the context of Confederate statues and the State Park and sort of all these sort of places in my world that are marked by eugenics, but might not speak to that past very loudly.
Just give us a sense of how they do record part of the history and not the other part of the history. How do they actually manage that?
They just leave a 100-year gap in the history. So it's a commercial development and it is a historical structure. So it has been required to kind of pass through the hands of historians on the road to get things like historic tax credits. But as branding, the history that appears on their website, for example, is really short, just a couple paragraphs long. It's got a very kind of buoyant history about these people that I talked about earlier, the people that wanted to afford a more humane treatment of people with mental illness. Those people are recognized, and the architectural connections to those individuals are recognized as people who built certain buildings on the site, which you will see today as a visitor. But everything else is just 100-year history. It was, you know, he was there, and then in 1981, blah, 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 blah. And so that's kind of how that's played out. And largely in Stanton, there's nowhere that you can really go to engage with that history. There's a neat historical society here that puts on programs. In the past couple of years, you know, the one has been about eugenics, and that's great, but there's no historical markers. There's no, there's a graveyard at Western State that's not marked. So there's a lot of ways that this past is really silent, that it could be louder and more integrated into the community, I feel.
That's a mass grave, right?
Yeah. I don't know if mass grave is the right term. It's a grave where people are buried anonymously. There's many thousands of them, and they're buried in stacked graves. And so that's the context of that. It is, you know, it is a cemetery where people were not buried with their names recorded or their dates of their birth or death recorded. They were recorded, given a number that corresponds to records that are confidential due to privacy laws. So it is a nameless, you know, a cemetery of the nameless dead.
And it's not, and they got a loophole for that as well, right? I mean, there's a Virginia statute that says that you need to show a little more deference to those type of things. And
Virginia did pass a law that said, you know, you can't do that anymore. You have to at least use things like durable grave markers. But there is no, you know, they couldn't retroactively apply it to people who had already been buried in the past. And so that's one layer of the site kind of persisting in that state.
We should also say that the architecture that the inn has adopted was a function of Western State, which in many ways was, you know, an example of that, of the labor of these people being exploited, and it's sort of imprinted, you know, it lasted, you know, I guess 80 years, it carried into the future. I mean, let's talk about like where that history goes, because it is, you know, I've mentioned this on the program before. Early on in my radio career, I had the opportunity to interview Gore Vidal a couple of times, and he come in studio and he was talking about the United States of Amnesia. And I had no real understanding of what he meant at the time. And I appreciate it a lot more. But where does that history go? And how, like, why is that era in particular, it seems to me, you know, from 1870, let's say, to 1930, you know, late 20s, maybe even the early, you know, mid 20s. Why is all that stuff seems to be like hoovered up in some way and just sort of jettisoned into the ether?
I think that history always remains, you know, for the people that it matters to. But you can, you know, just take stock of the recent controversy about things like the 1619 Project to understand that part of the reason why there's not kind of, I think, wider discussions about this history in general is because there's pushback. It is talking about it has become de-incentivized. And I say that as a historian who kind of has watched my profession shrink over the last two decades. So really there's very little, it has a negative value almost. So for example, one of the reasons I'm sure that they don't talk about history or the history of eugenics at this hotel in Ice Development is because it might tarnish the modern value of this property. And so what do you do when you have something that you want to talk about that has, you know, a negative value to society and sort of like the terms that, and this sort of capitalist society that we live in. But, you know, the other part of it is just, I think that people pick and choose which historical sins they want to recognize. And sometimes people, particularly white people, think, well, I'm going to recognize kind of one bad thing that happened in the past. And that sort of, you know, the sort of like the legacy and scars of enslavement is sort of a default position for, I think, a lot of white people who want to kind of approach the past with more clear eyes, and they just don't get up to sort of the successive years. So there's so many reasons and so many layers to why we have the versions of the past that we have. And I think the important thing to remember is these versions and layers, you know, are artificial to some extent. Just because we don't talk about something more doesn't mean it doesn't matter as much. The past and who gets to narrate the past is an incredible power struggle between people who are going to be ultimately mismatched in terms of resources in the end.
Well, I'm bringing it to present day just because I think it's so relevant, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the racism aspect of eugenics is just the thing that sticks out is what I in my mind is most important. Mm-hmm. You see this medical racism that is so prevalent. Black women obviously have a lot higher mortality rates when it comes to giving birth. they're less likely to be treated for pain management in a serious way. Can you talk about some of the shadows of the history that you're talking about here, which is not, it's fairly recent history, so of course there are going to be many shadows, or shades, I should say, on present day?
So you can look at a state like North Carolina, for example, where Black women were disproportionately sterilized. And the reason that they were disproportionately sterilized is their eugenics laws worked a little bit different and allowed social workers to select members of the public to sterilize, as opposed to a state like Virginia, where somebody undergoing that procedure would have to be admitted to a state hospital as a psychiatric patient ahead of time. And so the justification that kind of accompanied that aggressive, those aggressive actions by North Carolina was that, again, this language of draining resources, and particularly a program called Aid for Dependent Children, comes up. And so in this context, you can see eugenics, it is most hostile and naked. It's not just the idea that we're not going to help people to survive, we're going to be actively hostile towards the mere act of their survival. People who have disfavored minds and bodies don't just have the right, you know, shouldn't just not be born, but should not survive as well. And so in a lot of ways, we still see that today, particularly in some states like California as well. Incarcerated people, and particularly Black women, have been subjected to unconsented sterilization procedures while incarcerated, particularly women who are forced to give birth while incarcerated. And those, that's really hard to track too, because there's all these procedures, that all these things that can happen to pregnant people and to women that are, you know, presented as coincidental, similar to what women experienced in ICE custody. And so people are still incredibly vulnerable to these forces today. And we've been talking about them, I think you know, as recently as several months ago, a big story hit about that.
Well, we had to remove your uterus. We just had to.
Yes.
Right. I mean, that's kind of what we saw. And I guess we're with the ICE detention facilities, and as we're seeing it throughout prisons.
I just want to return to, for a moment, for something you said about the disincentives to remembering this and the shrinking of the history profession on some level, because, and maybe my perspective on this is just myopic because of just, you know, what I do. But I get a real sense that there is, we are in an era of concerted, like sort of, correctives and you know, I mean this in the most positive sense of revisionist history, where a lot of these eras that have been lost, and sort of more attention to the lost cause myth, and you know, we had a couple of years ago a bevy of work on the role that cotton played and you know, in the economy of North and South. And Is it your sense as well that maybe the fact that the history as a field is in some ways shrinking, that there's less incentive structure there, that there's actually less maybe money in that world, that people are taking more risks and are not as a, you know, concerned about going to a counter narrative, because if you can't, if there's no ladder to move up, you're not as worried about, you know, sort of like knocking a couple of rungs off it.
I mean, I think that certainly applies to someone like me. I trained as a historian and did a PhD and sort of had aspirations to remain as a teacher in the academy. And certainly if I had achieved that, I would be writing a very, very different kind of history. And I don't think that there would be a chilling kind of First Amendment suppression thing going on. It's just that the system of rewards and incentives and sort of freedoms that I lived in would be much different. And so the history that I write now, I have, you know, I have a certain kind of freedom to write that, without the similar conventions. And I think for me, I'm better suited, to it. And so I think that's kind of a fascinating question. But also, I would say that who gets to be a historian has changed differently. So we're not just thinking about academics, we're thinking about people who are doing community history work. We're thinking about people like journalists who write history. We're thinking about people who interpret history in the public eye. People who are doing sort of, you know, social media history, bite-sized history. And so all of those things are kind of coming together and changing the way that history is told as well.
Lastly, just sort of bringing it up to the present day, you wrote something about the emphasis on race and genetics turns into a softer bordering of cultural theories. But ends up with the same conclusion. I know we've touched on this a little bit, but talk about that because, you know, in our sort of like corner of the world, where, you know, we spend too much time watching Tucker Carlson or, talking about Sam Harris's perspective on Islam or, you know, making sure that Charles Murray finally has an opportunity to have himself heard, that type of stuff.
Or God like, forbid, Dave Rubin.
I mean, that whole sort of genre, which is sort of in vogue in certain areas in our society. I mean, will you just talk about what that sentence means, for people?
So one of the reasons why I wrote a book about eugenics is, of course, the hospital that I live next to. But, you know, the other reason is that I've spent the last 2 or 3 years on the basis of my first book trying to talk to people about why this resurgence and sort of the genetic qualities of white resentment and white plight that kind of resurged in 2016 with the Trump election and with a hillbilly elegy, why that was very, very dangerous and kind of a thing that concerned me to see a resurgence in. Sort of this idea that there was some kind of deeper genetic story, sort of a similar, a shared ancestry that could explain what was going on in these pockets of rural America. And people really bought into that. And I was very, very disturbed by that. And so that's what I mean when I talk about sort of like the soft cultural borders. If we look at the career of somebody like Charles Murray, we can see a very hardline emphasis on race and genetics. And now he's talking about sort of like the genetic realities of class formation and class structure about white people. And so the conclusions are still sort of the same. It's just a slight sleight of hand has been applied to kind of twist that. As one falls out of fashion, the other one can supplant it. But of course, I think that there's been a certain amount of mainstreaming of these conversations, these hardline conversations again in the past 4 years too. So it will, you know, this resurgence that won't stop.
Why do you think it's so dangerous? I mean, I that may seem obvious, but what is the danger? Like, what is the path that it sets us on that becomes problematic?
I think that, you know, anytime that you say that somebody has a disfavored biology, disfavored genes, you're kind of, you're setting yourself towards an eventual path where you have to say, I think it would be better if there are fewer people like that in the world. And certainly we've seen kind of the progression of that in the last 4 years. And so that is, you know, that's one layer, this sort of like slippery slope thing. But also these ideas seem to gain traction in my world. They're used sometimes when people are trying to determine plans for addiction treatment, for example, this idea that maybe, you know, there's just like a genetic predisposition towards addiction in places like Appalachia, which are kind of a hugely problematic but big, you know, a big conversation. So those get casually applied to solutions and discussions that have a big impact on things here, especially when you're talking about really subjective matters like IQ and intelligence and sort of aptitude for upward mobility as well.
Elizabeth Catt, the book is Pure America, Eugenics and the Making of Modern Virginia. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We will take a little break, and then we will return and wrap things up for this Wednesday. All right, folks, we are back. We got a minute or two here. Let's play this clip. We were speaking, Tucker Carlson came up in the course of our conversation about eugenics. That's not to imply that were Tucker Carlson around in that era, that he would be a big proponent of eugenics.
There are other ways to deal with the gypsy problem.
Exactly. But here is, you recall the other day, Tucker Carlson was saying that if you see a teacher require a mask on a child at school, you should treat them as if they have just hit that child. Mm-hmm. Well, I give you this clip from the Hillsborough School Board meeting in Tampa Bay, Florida.
We don't need to. The science said that we don't need to. We're going to go out the door right here to the right. We do not need masks for our kids. It's child abuse. No, I'm not. Do not.
You're being escorted.
Take the mask off our kids.
Thank you for your feedback.
I apologize.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. Hey, look, we have some excitement, but we'll keep moving on.
The quote from Tucker last week, your response when you see children wearing masks as they play should be no different from your response when you see someone beat a kid at Walmart. Call the police immediately. Contact Child Protective Services. Keep calling until someone arrives. What you're looking at is abuse. It's child abuse, and you're morally obligated to attempt to prevent it. So,
I mean, who knows if that person got that idea from Tucker firsthand or secondhand or thirdhand, or maybe not at all. Maybe the idea of protecting other people, protecting teachers, protecting staff at schools, protecting other kids, other families, kids who might be immunosuppressed, et cetera, is they just came to their own conclusion that that was child abuse. But
well, who knows? I mean, he's only the highest rated cable show in the country, so he maybe he has an enormous amount of influence, and he knows that. So this is what he chooses to do with it.
And that's it for us today. We will be back again tomorrow, which is Thursday. And for those of you who are not leaving us, we're still here. And we may even, I don't know, do we have a clip from Tucker today? I mean, how can we not? Every night he seems to be
swinging
for the fences.
He had a guest on last night to talk about CIA wokeness, but...
Well, I don't know about that. We'll check in that. But just remember, folks, MIDI Doctors reminds me, remember to remind everyone to hit the like button and subscribe. Hit the like button and subscribe.
Yes.
Don't forget, also, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, so we can have people like Elizabeth Cad on to tell us the fascinating story of eugenics and how we can see the... maybe this is too much of a a pun, but we can see the DNA of the idea of eugenics in a lot of the modern day racist talk and frankly austerity.
And yeah, you brought up I threw Dave Rubin in there as a joke, but and before I knew where you were going with it too, you brought up Sam Harris and. He's not necessarily saying there's something inherent in Muslim people's like DNA that causes them to be violent. He's just one step away from it. It's the evolved version of the exact dynamic she's talking about, right? Which is that it's just something inherent in their religion.
Yes, exactly.
So it makes it a little more palatable. But it's the same.
It's the culture shift. You move on from biology to like it's a problem in their culture. And you see that in Appalachia. You see that with the talk about Black American. Yeah, like you're talking about.
Right.
That was specifically her quote. It goes from genetics and DNA into a determinate cultural factor there.
Right.
Yes. And so we see that today and, you know, all around us.
Then it fits into their culture as static, you know, perspective.
And all meant to obscure relationship to power and modes of production, which actually create these things.
Yes.
There you go, folks. And all that all on the free show. So if you want to support that, go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member today. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. We are well over 2,000 people on the Discord. In fact, I think last I checked, we were like, where are we at? Like 2,900? I always have trouble trying to figure out where I find the data on that. Oh, here it is. 2,200. Sorry, 2,200 members of the Discord. You can go to majoritydiscord.com. Soon we're going to integrate this stuff with membership. We'll have membership, special membership features. Kyle's building all that, so check that out. And also amquickie.com. Did I say that? amquickie.com. 7 minutes of headline news every morning in the podcast form, or you can watch it as a YouTube at Majority Audio on YouTube. And of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off every time you buy a bag of Just Coffee. Glenn Greenwald gets a pair of wings. So that's...
Oh, he's going to have a lot of wings.
So it's all the better to fly.
I think you only need two, but, you know, what do I know?
Don't forget, check out Nomi's show today at 3 p.m. The Nomi Key Show, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And... on Femme Friday, last Friday, I think Jamie was on.
So, oh, cool.
So folks can go check that out. If you don't want to catch up to the live show at 3 p.m., but she's got plenty of stuff, content on YouTube as well. And speaking of other programs, what is happening, Matt, in the Lekian media empire?
Yeah, tomorrow night on Left Reckoning, Luke Savage, staff writer Jacobin, will join us to talk about pharma and Bill Gates, and will, you know, lament the end of his marriage. That makes it hard, I think, for everybody to believe in love a little bit as we sort of prepare to, you know, release COVID restrictions on dating. But anyway, that's tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, patreon.com/Left Reckoning. You get the post game, but go subscribe on YouTube, folks.
Lem, that's what it'd be, right? Lekian, oh, no.
Media Unit, no. LMU.
So that didn't work. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is number. See you in the fund half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fund half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a bad man.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on!
Fuck them, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, total, 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 pussy.